We've taken our microphones backstage at the beautiful Drury Lane Theater for a chat with one of Hollywood's greatest names. Our guest this afternoon is one of the superstars of the silver screen, a man whose acting career was literally born in a trunk on the New York stage in the comedy Getting Gertie's Garter, and who stepped with ease from the stage to the screen when he was summoned to Hollywood to star in The Front Page. Pat O'Brien, welcome to Those Were the Days.
Thank you very much. We better correct one thing, and that is that it wasn't on the New York stage Getting Gertie's Garter, but it was in the pre-days of stock companies that were the stepping stone of the springboard for Broadway. It was in a stock company in Plainfield, New Jersey. The name of the play, however, was Getting Gertie's Garter. And in that stock company with me, or should I say I was with him, was Percy Kilbride, who years later appeared with me on Broadway in a play called The Up and Up, along with Sam Levine.
Percy Kilbride.
Yeah. You remember that series they had?
The Lon Parkettle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what about this trunk episode from Getting Gertie's Garter?
What do you mean?
How did it happen? You were locked in the trunk, weren't you?
Well, the particular situation is where Billy, that was the name of the character, gets in the trunk and to hide from the leading lady. And then when she gets on, he opens the trunk and says, "Here I am." And well, unfortunately, the trunk, the lock slipped. And the trunk locked itself. And here we are with a packed house. There were always packed houses in those days, like it is now here at the Drury Lane. Well, I started knocking at the door. You get a little panicky, you know. And because it wasn't her entrance for some time, because I had a lot of business of looking around and, you know, casing the joint and everything. So I was rapping on the thing, and the trunk was jumping all around the stage. And finally, she realized, I'll never forget her name, Louisita Valentine was the leading lady. And she knew something was wrong. You know, this wasn't part of the plot, so she walked out. And she said, "Billy, are you a ghost?" Which was a line in the play. And with that, I was to open the trunk and say, "No, here I am." But I couldn't open the trunk, so she said, "Billy, are you a ghost?" And I screamed, "No, but it's only a question of time when I will be."
And how did you get out of the trunk?
Property man walked on stage and took a hammer and smashed the lock. And by this time, they knew that it wasn't part of the play. And, of course, they all applauded. And that's a lot of fun. It happens frequently in the round. You know, they become a participant in the affairs, and things so often happen. I remember Conrad Nagel telling us, and he was in, I don't mean to digress, but
it
was part of the story anyway.
Sure.
He was telling my wife, Eloise, and myself, he was playing right near Hershey, Pennsylvania, in the round, and had this very high comedic scene in the drawing room, and he was being very Chesterfieldian, lighting the cigarette for the leading lady, and he pressed it once, and it didn't work, and again, and he's trying to be very savoir faire, and nothing happens. About the fifth time, the fellow stood up in the front row and reached over and lit the cigarette, and the play went on. He didn't do it to be an extrovert or anything. He was helping the play, and when it set down again, the play went on.
That's the warmth of being so close to the stage, as audiences are right here at Drury Lane.
Yes, and as I said to you before the show, or before your show recording, it's radio will sustain itself through the years just for that reason. It might outlive all the media, because it still has great access to the imaginative powers of a human being, and it's great for the human mind to hear and then to expand on your own values. And this is what happens in the theater around. When you go up that ramp, it's not like in the proscenium, you open the door and you go to the kitchen. You go up that ramp and it's the audience got to believe, and they do believe, that you're in the kitchen or the garden or up in the bedroom. So there, as the years go on and you're playing around, you realize that some of its potential values, and you automatically, to repeat what I say, expand them as you go along, you know. And it's wonderful to see how the people, you can almost read their minds, but their concentration in the round sometimes is amazing, because in the theater, And for seeing him, you almost expect it. It's a sort of a dynasty through the years that you come to the theater and that's it. When around, it has such intimacy that you wonder if people are going to concentrate that long because they, you know, they have such proximity with mm-hmm. the actors. But they do. And I think it proves that the people, as an audience, are becoming educated to the theater of the round. Well, after all, the theater of the round was first. Came along before Christ.
Oh, certainly. Years ago.
All the Greek plays done around.
Do you, we do want to talk about your movie career, but let's talk about the stage. You were a rather established performer on the stage long before you went into films.
Oh, yeah, the theater has been my love. Excuse me, since I went on the stage, which was in 1920, I'm going into my 52nd year in show business, and I was very excited and honored. 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, the Lambs Club in New York gave me a testimonial on my 50th year in show business. But
the Lambs is one of your great loves, isn't it?
The Lambs and the Players.
Uh-huh.
Players is down in Gramercy Park. The Lambs probably more so because I went into the Lambs in 1926. I went in with Bert Wheeler and Charles Lindbergh, which was pretty good company.
You didn't fly in, did you?
Sometimes I had to fly out because I couldn't pay my dues.
What about the time that you had you crawled into the Lambs?
Oh, that was when Winchell printed that article. Well, I'd been suspended in the Lambs for something that was completely I was faultless, but I had a guest in there who had an overabundance of the sauce and. On returning to the club, he was living at the club as my guest. He got violently ill right in the lobby of the Lambs Club. I wasn't even there, but because I had sponsored him, and he wasn't the Lambs, so somebody had to be the rat man. So they suspended me, and I think it was for 90 days. And this is while I was in Hollywood. I was I was there to do a radio show, I think, at the time, the Theater Guild or something. So you feel, a little chagrined by it all. So I never mentioned it at home. And so anyway, after about a week, I was living at the Astor Hotel, which is right down the street from the Lambs on 44th Street in New York. And I would walk by on the other side of the street and look with the lonely glances at my alma mater, the Lambs. And, you know, members would see me, and, of course, they finally prevailed upon the shepherd of the club. I forget who it was at that time. William Gaxton, I believe. So they said, well, after all, it wasn't really his fault, so they lifted the suspension. And they notified me by phone. It was just a block away the next day. So when I came in, I started at the door of the Lambs, the entrance, and through the lobby, and through the grill room and right into on my hands and knees, I crawled. So Winchell heard about it, and he put it when he had this column, and he said the greatest example of humility was Pat O'Brien crawling on his hands and knees from the door of the Lambs Club through the grill room right to the bar. It was his destination. Well, it appears all over the country, and Mommy, my wife, Eloise, read it. And she says, why didn't you tell me about this, you know? Well, I said, I guess I felt a little ashamed and everything, but I didn't want to tell you that I'd been suspended. And then, of course, through the years, you realize you're never a real lamb unless you've been suspended. Like we used to say at Warner Brothers, you were never at Warner's unless you'd been suspended at least once. So I belong to both of those leagues. But the denouement had to come from Winchell. And it was amazing. And she said, well, you should have told me. She said, probably if I were there, I'd have crawled in with you.
Well, you would have made a nice twosome down there, crawling over to the bar. Pat O'Brien, you met your wife, Eloise, right here in the Chicago area, didn't you?
Right here in Chicago. The theater is now called, I always want to say the Pilly Rose Theater. It's called right next to the Harris. It used to be the Selwyn.
The Mike Todd.
Mike Todd. Why correlate those names, I have no idea, but I keep saying that all the time.
You were in a play called Broadway.
Broadway, that's right, and I was in the one-night stand company in the South, and I got word in Atlanta. And when we got to Atlanta, Jed Harris, the producer, said that this, because of its size, and we've been playing all the tiny urban cities of the South, so there were one-nighters or three-nighters. Atlanta, we played for 2 weeks. And where else did we play for? Anyway, I got word that they were taking Joe King, who was in the play Broadway in the Chicago company, transferring him to New York to play in the Royal Family. So the same role that I was playing in the South, I replaced him in Chicago. And as I walked through the stage door, which was the latter part of 1927, or the part of 28, I don't exactly recall, this gal walked through the stage door at the same time. She'd been also sent out, but from the New York company, to replace a girl in the Chicago company who had gotten a better engagement or something. So I took one look at her, especially, as I say in the book, I took one look at those beautiful gams, and that was for me, and that's all those years ago, and it took me nearly 4 years to catch her. We were married, and after Howard Hughes brought me to California, we're married 40 years. We'll be married 41 years next January.
41 years.
And strangely enough, in this play that we're doing now, there's a line in it, and it's a repetitive line. It's we have a little one of those domestic quarrels apropos of not going to Paris. And that's the significance of the title, and I say, I'm trying to make up with it. I say, I play this as an Irishman. Strangely enough.
Pat O'Brien is an Irishman?
Well, I'm going to explain that to you later. Why? I mean, because obviously with the brogue, and I say, I see you're wearing my favorite bathrobe. And she said, I guess you didn't hear me. I'm not going, Dan. No, I'm not going to you. And besides, it isn't a bathrobe. It's the hostess style. Well, whatever it is, I like it. There's only one thing that does cover up those gorgeous legs of yours. I've been going back over 40 years. Pretty good. Pretty good. Still have those gorgeous gams. So, strangely enough, in the play Broadway, that's the way I fell in love with my wife. I'm sorry. To clarify what I said in the beginning, the connotation of this play in its entirety and how we approached it, we were playing in New England on a summer circuit last summer. We're doing the same play we've done here, Me and Thee. So we're playing in Skowhegan, and a playwright came by, and he had a play. He asked me to read it and asked if we would do it the following year, which is now less than a year. So I read it, and then I said, well, you're in New York. We're going to have to be close here. We go to Nyack. Well, he said, I'll come up and he'd seen the play in Skowhegan and wanted to know if we wouldn't do it. Came to Nyack, asked if I'd read the play, and I said, yes. And I said, I loved it for us because it's very suitable for my wife and daughter. But I said, it would be quite impossible to play it as you've written it because it has a very definite Semitic connotation. It's a Jewish play. Uh-huh. Sam Levine and Molly Picon played it on Broadway.
Oh.
And I said, if you wouldn't mind, if I would change your character to an Irishman and let the rest of the characters, you know, play it straight, and Hattie is, without utilizing any dialect or anything, is obviously a Jewish gal and is my wife's closest friend in the play, which is pretty true to life anyway, because the closest friend at home was a Jewish gal. So he said, well, I don't care. And he said, so all we did, with his permission, we didn't change one iota, change the rhythm, some of the Jewish idioms, the cadence, but in context, not one thing. He could play it in Chinese. So he came a week ago Saturday. He came up from New York to see it, and he was so happy.
This
so
is the great author, Richard Seth.
That's right. Richard Seth.
And the play is Paris Is Out.
Paris Is Out. And it works, the change in the and the racial connotation doesn't mean one thing. It's the, of course, the Jewish people and the Irish people, or the Catholics particularly, have so much in common, even ecclesiastically. You know, we took a lot of the Jewish ritual and incorporated it in Catholicism into the Mass and everything. So the whole thing works beautifully, and as a consequence, it's become a great word-to-mouth production, which definitely actuates or is a great impetus for business, more so than the advertising. It's the greatest advertising in the world. Nobody knows better than yourself. It's been locally expounded by people who've seen it.
Word of mouth, that's kind of well, people can get up and out to Drury Lane and see Pat and Eloise and Bridget O'Brien in a Jewish play with Irish accents all through it. I think that'll be fun.
No, you must qualify that. Mine is the only Irish accent.
Oh, everyone else is
straight. Completely straight. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I wasn't trying to emulate O'Casey, your thing, Yeats. In other words, I wasn't trying to bring the Abbey from Dublin to Chicago.
Let's go back to those early days of acting on the stage. You're a good friend of yours, according to your great book, The Wind at My Back, was a fellow by the name of Spencer Tracy, and you went to acting school together.
Went to parochial school together.
Parochial
school. 12 years old. In Milwaukee, where we were both born and raised. And we enlisted together in 1917, the First World War. And when the war was over, we came back and finished high school in our uniforms. And then he went to Ripon College in Wisconsin. And I went to Marquette University, Jesuit. And we didn't finish because there was a law passed, I guess we call it the first GI Bill, but it was each state passed their own particular law within the state itself. Wisconsin would give you $10 for every month you'd served, or $30 a month in a college of your choice. Well, we set forth to prove that there wasn't any college or university in Wisconsin that had any course at that time, which was in 1919, after the war, that taught exclusively taught drama. None of them. They might have had maybe one class or something where you studied dramatics or phonetics or something like that. So we chose to go to New York, and legislature or whatever agreed, and we both went to the American Academy of Dramatic Art. And when we left there, and we set forth, and our first job, and that was while we were going to school in New York, was in IUR. It was a drama written by Capek. I believe he was Hungarian or Czech, I don't know, a great playwright. And he also wrote The Insect Story, I think it was called. And we both played rubbets in it. R-U-R's translation is as Rossum's Universal Rubbets. And after a few weeks, he got one line to read, and we started at $15 a week, and I quit at 15 too. But he got a one line, and they raised his salary to 25. But I stayed at 15 because I never did get a line. So we stayed, and then until the play closed, and of course, then we set forth on our individual paths for hopes of the pot of gold and playing all the various stock companies around the country. And finally you achieve, you know, what you set forth to accomplish, and that's Broadway. And he was the first to come to Hollywood of our group. No, Cagney was. Cagney was doing a play with Joan Blondell by George Kelly, Grace Kelly's uncle, called Maggie the Magnificent. He was one of the great playwrights of his day. He wrote The Show Off, which Helen Hayes played here just a couple of years ago. Cagney was the first to go. Well, Gleason, actually, he'd come.
James Gleason.
Yeah, he came out during the silent pictures. See, none of us had ever done a silent picture, Spence or Jimmy or myself, or Bellamy or Overman or Morgan. Overman, I think. And Morgan did, Frank. Yeah, they'd done several. They had us, had it on us a little in mileage, too, though, age-wise. Well, anyway, Spence did a wonderful play, and I went to the opening, I'll never forget it, sat up in the gallery because I was broke. It took 16 curtain calls, the last mile. And John Ford brought him out to the, in my book, The Greatest Director. He and Kaplan and who else would I say was a good, I'll get into that later, great directors. Brought him to Hollywood to play in a picture, I don't recall it, but the juvenile in it was Bogart, Humphrey Bogart. And that was Spence's first picture. And then he came back, and the last mile continued with Alan Jenkins, I think, who was in the cast and was an understudy, played it while Spence was doing the picture. Mm-hmm. Then when I went to Chicago, Tommy Mitchell played the role. So he only did that one picture, and he came back and finished it, but he had a contract with Fox to return, because even though the picture wasn't a big hit, and then he was under contract with Fox, I don't know, 3 years, and Thalberg saw this great, exciting talent that this man had, who could do anything from light comedy to farce to drama, low comedy, you do pratfalls if you ask it, anything. Mm-hmm. So Thalberg bought his contract, and I was the third of the group. Frank McHugh had preceded all of us, as I say, with the others. And I came when I was rehearsing in a play with Herbert Marshall and Zita Johann, and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Philip Barry. Quote Shakespeare, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. Uh-huh. And strangely enough, the man who replaced me was Tony Perkins' father. Osgood Perkins. Yeah. Hmm. Howard Hughes bought my contract from Gilbert Miller for $10,000, which naturally I didn't get any, and brought me to California, my first trip anyway, I guess outside of Milwaukee, and, you know, on the road, I mean, contractually.
Well, how did Howard Hughes operate this? Did he call you up, or did he talk to you directly?
His man in New York called me, uh-huh, and said that what had happened was I was doing a play called The Up and Up at the Biltmore Theater, in which Sam Levine, Percy Kilbride, and Dorothy Stickney were playing, Howard Lindsay's wife, who was co-author of many great plays, including State of the Union, Sound of Music. And Hearst, who used to take a group of Hollywoodians to Europe every year for a vacation, and didn't cost them a quarter, and they would spend a week in New York and go to all the theaters. And they had purchased a block of tickets for the play across the street, which was Connolly's play, you know, the all-Negro play at the Mansfield. Oh, they made a picture of it. Sensational play. Won the Pulitzer Prize.
I can't think either.
All Negro play about heaven and all the biblical characters, and they were all Negroes. Oh, it's a beautiful play, and the picture was beautiful.
Green Pastures.
Green Pastures, yeah. Green Pastures. I always remember the wonderful telegram that Ring Lardner sent Mark Connelly. The theater had been closed for a long time. And, of course, in the parlance of the theater, you know, it's equivalent. When I tell you, he sent him a telegram, the opening of the reviews were wonderful. And they said, here's hoping the Mansfield stays dark for a year.
The reverse all the time.
We always say the theater's closed, it's mm-hmm. dark, you know. Mm-hmm. And because of its black connotation, it was a pretty brilliant telegram. Mm-hmm. And it could have played as long as, you know, it wanted to. And, brilliant acting, everybody in the play. And some, you wonder why they didn't go on. Probably today, when they're, you know, getting breaks that they deserved in the arts, probably everybody in that cast would have gone on. Of course, I'm talking now, this is over 40 years ago. Mm. So, I'm getting away from my story. So they didn't have enough tickets to go around. They weren't short. So Milestone, who's a director in Hollywood, said, oh, place is sold out, forget it. I'll go across the street to see what's over there, and we'll all meet after the show. And he looked up at the marquee and didn't know anybody on it. I probably knew Dorothy Stickney, but didn't know who Paddle Barn was. And so anyway, I went across the street, he said, you got a ticket for the matinee? And the guy said, yeah. And he, well, in the play, the character I played was a bookmaker who talked with a great rapidity and accelerated dialogue and all that. He laid this on so often. I'm going to go home and play in Belmont or something. He's going to be over that aqueduct. You know, it's like an auctioneer. Well, the character in front page, which Hughes had just purchased, the character of Hilly Johnson, had a great similarity because there was he talked on two phones simultaneously, which I did in the play. Only in the bookmaking companies. So Millie called Howard Hughes, because he was the direct front page, and said, I saw some young fellow in this play, and I didn't even make tests.
No screen test at all?
Nothing. Bought me just, you know, as a pig in a poke. And away I went. And, of course, it was really a case of mistaken identity, because in the meantime, he called, and then they called me, the Lambs Club, Howard Hughes' representative. And I was rehearsing by that time, months, but they didn't call me for months. I didn't know he was at the play. He didn't come back and congratulate me or anything. And I got this call because the Up and Up was in there, had closed. And I went on into rehearsal for Gilbert Miller in this other play, Tomorrow. And all of a sudden, one evening in the Lambs Club, about dinner time, I got a call and said, Howard Hughes producing front page, and you played front page, didn't you? And I said, yes. And that's all they want to know. Now, they didn't ask me whether I'd played it on Broadway, and they didn't ask me what role I'd play. Well, the contracts were drawn up within 24 hours after Miller agreed to sell my contract if he got Oscar Perkins for the role. It was up in New England. Everything worked out beautifully. So I had them put into the contract that Houston, he didn't care. As a matter of fact, I could have gotten $100,000 if I wanted in, but I didn't know Howard Hughes from Chief Justice Hughes. I didn't, really. Because, as I say, it's over 40 years ago. And so I had them put in the contract, and there was no beef at all that I was engaged to a girl and that she should be brought to Hollywood, because so they did. They put it in there. She came to Hollywood, and we were married, and so Millie wanted to rehearse the picture like you do in a theater, because he had a lot of people from the theater in it. Walter Catlett, Frank McHugh, Edward Everett Horton, Louis Walheim, who started out and died on the picture. And then Manju took over. Died during rehearsal.
Adolf Manju.
No, Walheim died during the rehearsal.
And then Adolf Manju took over, right.
So we rehearsed about a week, and he said, Patty, what did you do when you went to the desk? And those within the sound of my voice who know front page realize about what I'm speaking. When you carried the murderer over to the desk, I said, I didn't carry him over there because I never played this part. Well, he said, they told me that they called you in New York. I said, they did. Well, he said, you told them. I said, no. Millie, all they asked me was, did you play in front page? I said, I did. I said, I happened to have played it in a stock company in Cleveland, Ohio, and I didn't play Hilda Johnson. I played the managing editor. And he blew his stack, and he went, well, I said, I'm sorry, Millie, I got a contract, and that was it. And he said, well, maybe the picture will work out. It worked out, and how lucky can you get? Your first picture, it was a smash.
It was great. It was a smash. And we'd like to keep talking about your great movie career, and we'll continue this.
One thing we'd rather forget it, because while we're on the subject, Columbia bought the rights to it, remade the picture, called it My Girl Friday, and you know who played my part? Rosalind Russell.
Ros Russell. Pat O'Brien was replaced by Ros Russell in the remake, and we'll be back after this word. We're back at the Drury Lane Theater with our guest today on Those Were the Days, Pat O'Brien. Pat O'Brien, when you went to Hollywood for the role of Hilda Johnson in the front page, that was a pretty interesting thing to get a starring role immediately And zing, your film career was right off the ground. None of this apprenticeship, I guess, as in the B films and things like that. You had your training on Broadway.
That's right. And in those, excuse me, I guess the only way to make a comparison of values, if that's the way to phrase it, in all those years that I've been out there, no matter what I've done, my name has never been off the marquee, which is pretty fair for a kid that started as a young man of 31, and now here I am, 71.
Just the same as the year.
Yeah, I'm always the age of the year. I was born in 1899, and my boyhood friend, Pal, was born in 1900. He was 6 months younger than I am, Spence.
Well, you must have been operating on daylight saving time all these years, because you don't look like you're 71.
Thank you. Bogey was born the same year I was. Cagney was born. Strange, we were all born within a year or so of each other. The only baby of our group, and I think he was maybe 4 years or 3 years younger, that's Bellamy.
Mm-hmm.
And Garden.
Well, you all came together in New York then.
That's right. We all met then.
Well, what did you, when you weren't working on the stage, or you weren't, well, maybe when you were meeting at the Lambs Club or the Players, what did you guys do? What did young fellas, Pat O'Brien and Humphrey Bogart, James Cagney and Ralph Bellamy,
kept looking for work, and we didn't wait for the phone or ring or anything. Go ahead and stock company. There weren't any commercials in those days, Mostly sit around like a lot of old broads, I guess, talking and gossiping, And with high hopes, we all thought that someday we'd make it.
Did you ever dream that you would all be somewhere involved? I guess every one of you were brothers, weren't you?
It was quite
one time or another?
All except Overman and Morgan, Frank Morgan.
He was with MGM.
And Bellamy. Morgan was with MGM. Overman was with Paramount. Bellamy was at Columbia for a while, but I think mostly a freelancer. Bill Frawley, he'd never been under contract, but he was for years in with Jesse. You know, he played the brother-in-law.
Oh, yeah. Fred Mertz.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he was a part of the group. And as a matter of fact, Capra mentions in the book the Irish Mafia with Vince Tracy, Overman, Cagney, Battlebine. Bogey was never a member of that group. Bogey was a little different than all of us. He wasn't the easiest guy to know, but if he did know him, he always had a deep affection for him and a great respect for his artistry and achievements.
You were
in the club, you know, and we weren't all members. Jimmy was never a joiner, so we didn't spend that much time in the Lambs. We'd probably be at, you know, some inexpensive restaurant like the Blue Ribbon or something, where you could go in and order a glass of beer and eat a lot of bread. Until they got on, they didn't put any bread on the table. You know. But they were wonderful days, and because I never go on the wonderful days. They were great. Great to talk about, but hell, it's going to be great days tomorrow. It's great today, just sitting here talking with you. What can be greater? Let's put it in one sentence that Eddie Robinson had in a play years ago. It's great to be alive.
Absolutely. And I'll answer the question. Nothing could be greater than being here chatting with you today.
Well, thank you. No, you look around and you've got to count your blessings when you see the people that are immersed in suffering and everything. And I was in Vietnam just a year and a half ago. I have a son over there. We have a son. Second tour of duty. And I spent a lot of time when I wasn't entertaining, going around the hospitals. And I remember up in the, right out of Saigon, and going into this hospital, they brought a kid in from Birmingham, colored boy, about 19. He'd stepped out of mine, both legs had been blown off, and part of his face gone. The guy looked at me, they'd given him a couple of injections, and he said, and they said, this is Pat O'Brien. I said, hey, man, you come all the way over here, say hello to us? And he passed out again. And I often wondered whether he ever lived through or doesn't get his name, but it was, you know, it was a shocker. And this dear little fellow, that was what he was thinking of, that somebody else had made a sacrifice. And he's the guy that had made the sacrifice. And I missed seeing my son over there because he was fine and some other. But he's over there now,
Well, you did a lot of entertaining overseas and even at home, too, didn't you?
Oh, yes. In World War II. China, Burma, India, Africa, Persia.
Flying the hump.
Yes, which very few actors did. That's one thing I've got on Bob Hope. He never flew the hump. All the entertaining he's done is probably the greatest of them all as far as expending his time. See, the actors that flew the hump, I think the first to fly was Joey Brown. And then Paulette Goddard, Ann Sheridan, Bill Gargan, Keenan Wynn. And then we had a group of six, Jinx Falkenberg and Jimmy Dodd and his wife, Perry Brown, and Betty Eaton and myself.
Isn't there a story about where you were really in there only, 25 miles from where the fighting was, and it was a blackout, and they had the GIs on the floor holding candles or something?
Yeah, they were the human footlights. They held the candles, and the booming and the Japanese were advancing all the mm-hmm. time. They were, I don't know how many kilometers away, but not too far. And General Chenault flew us out the next day into Chungking, and then the demolition squad stayed over and blew up the field, which was an $80 million airfield, ours. Mm. Oh, yeah, some very exciting experiences over there, and looking back, you know, in retrospect, you say, you wonder, you're in the first floor, and what the hell you were doing over there, and then you look around those kids, you know, wondering, there's something been over there for 3-4 years, and it was even worse than Vietnam from a standpoint of loneliness, because it was the filth that they had to endure over there. And of course, this loneliness is something that there's no medicine for, you know. And of course, Vietnam is worse because of this continuation. You know, it's like a 100-year war or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it was wonderful, and we did a lot of entertaining over here. And then, of course, I went into the Caribbean the first year of the war, and the French Guiana, British Guiana, Dutch Guiana, played within 30 miles of Devil's Island, which was exciting, all through the cannibal country. I was playing in a Lent, they weren't eating anybody.
So, in the early days of your screen career, Pat O'Brien, You had a role in a film at MGM, a film called Flying High. It was a Burt Lahr picture.
And that was his first picture.
His first picture. And it was about your third, I guess, or
third
picture, mm-hmm. something like that. Irving Thalberg was the wonder boy, I guess.
Nobody's ever touched him since. Great genius of all time. Young man. Oh, you mean about going into...
How did you get your role in that?
Well,
your agent was negotiating...
Jordan Selznick, Myron Selznick, and he sent his partner in with me, and he said, no matter what happens with Frank, do whatever he tells you. So we rolled up there in this Frank's Rolls Royce, to MGM. And he said, now remember, no matter what he says. Now, in the front page, my salary to start was $750 a week, which was a lot of money in those days, 1931.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I'd been receiving $350 on Broadway, which is a lot of money on Broadway. So when we went in there, and with the great God, Thalberg, although he never acted that role, he was a very humble and charming guy. I just loved him. But I just sat there, and he asked for $1,750 a week for me to play, and I nearly—he didn't tell me what he was going to ask for. And I went into shock, sitting in Thalberg's office. I'm sitting like over there, and Thalberg is where you are, and Joyce is where I am. And Thalberg went into shock too. Well, he said, "You know, there's no secret about it. You know, there's salaries, dues." He said, you know, maybe if you ask for... Well, by that time, my salary had gone to $1,500. I'd been there, 6 months or something, for Howard. And he said, but it hadn't gone to $1,500 yet. It was maybe in 2 months. So I'm still on the $750 payroll. Thalberg said, you know, you're out of your mind, you know. You don't even double it. You go $250 over that. Well, that's our asking price. We want a 3-week guarantee at $1,750. Well, if they'd said 1,000, you know, I'd been kind of shivery with a 3-week gas, it'd have been fine for me, you know, $3,000, because it's always a lot of money in those days. It's a lot of money today, let's face it, with taxes. So I just sat there, you know, and I'm getting, developing a penitentiary power all along the way. So I said, that was it. And he went home and he said, oh, no, that's, no, get up. I'm sorry. We walked out. We got halfway down the corridor, and Eddie Mannix, God have mercy on him, he's gone now, too, rushed out and he said, you crazy Irish so-and-so. He said, you realize you're going to job at work? And I said, well, talk to my guy here. Frank said, that's it. And then we got just to the door going out of the corridor. Mannix had his instructions, you know, let him go as far. All right, come back. I've got in. Thalberg just shook his wisdom and genius, Jewish crown, and said, so he capitulated, he succumbed to the offer. I signed for 3 weeks of $1,750. And it ran 11 weeks.
11 weeks. You really hit him good for that.
Yeah,
one.
They didn't know that in those days. See, well, Guy Kibbe was in that picture. And I don't forget, can't remember, Charlie Winninger was in it. I don't remember the girl. The girl wasn't too important a role because Bert was the one that was truly starting, you know, and he was one of the all-time great comedians.
After Flying High in 31, you were over at Universal from MGM, and
freelancing.
You filmed a movie called Airmail, and didn't an incident during the filming of that picture appear in Ripley's Believe It or Not?
It sure did. It was in the early days of not early days of flying, but 31, you know, it wasn't as highly developed it is now, but stands by an aircraft, and of course the picture was directed by my guy I think is the greatest director of all time, John Ford. So we had a scene where Ralph Bellamy was lost in the mountains, and I, as a compatriot flyer, was going to look for him. They said it was impossible that he was lost, and what's the use? And so I walked to the microphone with all the newspaper people and got buried into the microphone and jump in my plane and take off. So Ford, who chews handkerchiefs when he's, you know, the tension is high and everything, and he said, geez, it would be great if you could take this off the ground yourself. And I looked at him like, you know, I was going to, like he was a madman, you know. I said, what are you, daft or something? I said, I've never been in a plane, which I haven't. This is in 31. You can take it off the ground. So the trick flyer in those days was Paul Mantz. He flew a lot of the trick flying through the pictures that Jimmy and I did. And Devil Dogs of the Air, and then Here Comes the Navy, and other pictures, Ceiling Zero. So he comes over and he says to John Ford, he said, well, he said, this could, we could create this illusion very easily. He said, let Pat jump into the plane as the camera is grinding, and I'll be, it was a two cockpit plane, it's one of those chicken poops. And he said, I will be lying face down, and I will give it, while I'm on my face in the front cockpit, will give it the gun, and it looks from your camera lens, Pat is sitting up as we take off, like Pat will simulate the action like he took the plane off. Then we get airborne, I'll come up and take the plane, we'll fly around Alhambra Airfield where we did it, and then come back. Well, like a you're young, and you know, you're not only that, there's a lot of people there, and you want to show off. You want to be a hero. So I said, all right, and I was scared stiff. But I did it, and once I was there, boy, it was a huge adventure for me. And Paul Mantz turned around and smiled, and we circled the field a couple of times, and Zoom came in. And there was a long silence, a lot of applause. And because I think it had gotten around that I'd never been in a plane.
From the crew, and.
A lot of. Extras, hundreds of them, and people who, spectators. So Ford chews a handkerchief a while, and he says, you know, we've got to do one for protection. I don't know where this. By this time, I didn't care, you know. It's like a paratrooper says, hell, it's the first job, it's the second one. But it was worked in reverse with me. I didn't get into it. I had a young colored fellow working for us at the time. Eddie, his name was. Nicest little guy. Willie, I'm sorry. He's passed away. He was like one of the family. He knew that I'd never been in a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I heard later, of course. And as the plane takes off, you know, the first time, he looks up at the plane and looks at me getting into the plane and turns to some guy in the next room and says, "Uh-oh, there goes my job."
Well, you did a good job with that.
So Ripley had in his car, uh-huh. Remember, he used to have a Believe It or Not?
Sure.
Believe It or Not, Pat O'Brien took a plane off the ground and never been on an airship in his life. Mm. And then in the caption, he explained what had happened.
And you're just happy that the backup pilot there
yeah.
didn't have a heart attack while you were up in the air.
And then when I found Bellamy, as I recall, he had, I think he burned to death in the crash or something. He was just got there and I had to shoot him or something. I forget. It was really weird.
In the story.
Uh-huh. But it was a good picture. It was one of the, and the girl in it, never heard from her since. She's an English actress, Lillian Bond. But Slim Somerville was in it. And he's gone. Frankie Albertson was in it. He's gone. And but it's the only test I ever made in my life. And I was infuriated. You know, I made a big man. I made three pictures. Now I don't want to make a test. But Myron Selznick says, "Well, don't be an idiot. You're working for the greatest director in the business." So I made the test for him, only because it was, the Jack Ford image.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me later, he said, "You didn't have to make a test. But I just wanted to hear what your reaction was." And I figured you'd say that, so I said, "I'll make the test anyway." But he said, "You'd have gotten the role anyway."
When did you join the Warner Brothers?
1932.
Right after this, right at this time, I guess.
Well, no, I made a picture with Betty Davis, independent picture, to which she refers in her book as one of the worst things she's ever done. Which he was right. The worst things I've ever done, so we're making a dead heat. And then, strangely enough, the first picture I made at Warner's was with Betty Davis. It was called Bureau of Missing Persons. He didn't like that too much either. But I didn't care, because it was my first picture, and it isn't Betty. Then I made another independent picture with Louis Calhern and Mary Bryan, who had been my leading lady in Front Page. Oh, and then I did a picture with Carol Lombard at Columbia, Virtue. And then I did a picture with Genevieve Tobin called Hollywood Speaks. And then I think I went to Warner's.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long time.
Warner Brothers, you played all different kinds of characters there, from priests to lawmen to gangsters, I guess, about...
Don't forget, football coach.
Football coach. Oh, we're going to get to that. We're going to get to that.
Yeah, it was played a diversified group of people.
Warner's really had a reputation for turning out the gangster films in the 30s. They really did a lot of them. And
they were the best, too.
They sure were. They sure
rough,
were.
Rough, tough pictures. And, of course, Jimmy's first great picture, Public Enemy, which, incidentally, Gene Harrell was in.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course... Eddie Robinson's Wonderful Little Caesar.
Mm.
And then Paul Muni's Chain Gang. And, there were so many of them.
Warner Brothers had their own arsenal of weapons, I think, didn't they?
Well,
with
they did.
A whole business.
A regular warehouse.
In your book, The Wind at My Back, you mentioned something about a military man being on the set one day and wondering why the Warner Brothers machine guns didn't jam.
Yeah. See, that book was for... That's true. It was a picture we were doing with Armstrong and I called G-Men and his... It was a G-Men.
Uh-huh.
And Warner came down and explained that. What was it? You just read the book. I wrote it, but it was...
Well, he said something about... he couldn't understand why the Warner Brothers, the Tommy guns, didn't jam, and Jack Warner, I guess, came down and explained that they modified the machine gun because they couldn't think of having a machine gun jam in a Warner Brothers picture, and this fellow from the service took one of these things, and the government adopted that modification so that...
Yeah, that's right, and I think he went to work for Warner's in that, in particular, special effects, and, they were always searching for some new... gadgets, not to benefit society as much as to benefit Brothers Warner. And that sometimes it worked, and this was one of the times.
They even had a man who spent 50 years in and out of jail as a technical advisor on some.
Well, I got him that job.
You got him the job.
Yeah, it was on San Quentin with Humphrey Bogart and Nance Sheridan. His real name was Kelly. He was a professional pickpocket, or a dip, or a cannon, which is the name for them, actually. C-O-N-O-N is a pickpocket. Doc Stone. And it was an amazing thing happened. And those days, they were, some of those guys were on the hop pretty good, too, you know, on the junk. And there was a lot of them were cocaine sniffers. They used to call it nose candy. So I got him a job. We got $300 a week. I said, he just gotten out of the can, out of the Bastille. San Quentin, I forget. Another pickpocket rap. He didn't have to serve too much, you know. He was a steady customer. He was a boarder, you know, of the state. And I guess, so I was in the Brown Derby one day, and I was telling Bob Cobb, who owned the Derby. God have mercy on him, he's gone there too. I said, you know, I got a great spot for some guy. And of course, the director says, why don't you get one of your ex-con friends? I said, what do you mean my ex-con friends? They're all my pals, they're convicts. Well, I knew a few guys that served, some of them right here in Chicago. Which is about him in my book.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell him, Bob, he says, what about Doc Stone? He says, he'll be in here in a while. He comes in, steals some cigars here every once in a while. Well, he didn't come in that day, so I tried the next day, and sure enough, there's Doc. I met him, I told him, I said, it's a job, I have your name on the chair, and all you got to do is give us to the director, ostensibly, and tell him what happens in stir, you know, in the prison. Well, you know, he leaped at it like a trout up a stream.
Uh-huh.
So they gave him, he got $300 a week for just sitting there, and he was there for 2 weeks, his technical director, and pictures. And one day, didn't show up on time, and the noon went by, so Bacon turns to me and says, son, they're your friends. I said, listen, you're the one that asked for him. And I said, I'm not too concerned, but he'll be here. Oh, he came in around 3 o'clock. And as I say, we're doing a prison picture, San Quentin. So I came on and said, hell, I said, Doc, you crazy? I said, Bacon is raising the studio roof. You're late. And he says, first time I was late. And I said, yeah, but he says, what's the matter? Was there a beef? Well, I said, Bacon's pretty stormy right about now. So what he says, I can't repeat on the air. I mean, prefacing what he said. And he said, so-and-so, he said, if they say anything, I'll go over the wall.
Over the wall at Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
Even so, the technical advisor.
So that query and answer, I've told all around the world. Some places on the continent they don't know about over the wall, but I think most people do that have read enough gangster books.
How many times did you play a priest?
Well, let me see. The first time I played was Father Duffy in the Fighting 69th. Then I played the Fighting Father Dunn. And then I played the priest with Mickey Rooney in Fireball, which was just here on the screen in Chicago last week. And then in several TV productions.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, let me see, that's 4. I'd say about 8 times.
About 8 times all together.
Enough to qualify me to hear confession.
Well, maybe we'll hear a confession after we take a break for this word from one of our sponsors. Back with our guest, Pat O'Brien, this afternoon on Those Were the Days, reminiscing about some great days in Hollywood and a magnificent career. Pat O'Brien, the late 30s and the early 40s brought some wonderful films for you and for everyone who went to the movies. In the late 30s, you did The Fighting 69th, starring as Father Duffy with George Brent and James Cagney. And then 1940 was a great film, a film which has become one of the greatest football stories of all time. You starred as Canute Rockne, All-American. How did you get the role as Canute Rockne? Were you selected for the part, or did you try to get it, or just how did you become Canute Rockne?
No, I didn't try to get it. I think the first one who was a producer at the time at Warner who suggested it to Warner, that casting, was Mark Hollinger. And the knowing of my great affinity for the sporting world and every sport there is, I guess, except polo, which I can never afford to play. And, well, I guess Jack was a pretty good listener where Mark Ellinger was concerned. And there was no contest, except that I had to get the okay of Mrs. Rockney.
Mm-hmm.
So we made, not tests, but photographic tests in various wigs and makeup, which took 3 hours every morning. And she came on from South Bend to discuss the picture, and we met her, and she okayed the pictures without any comment, she definitely. And back at South Bend, came back a week later and lived with us as our house guest. And then she left, and then before the picture, Eloise, my wife, and I went to South Bend to live with the Rockneys in order that I might assimilate as best I could or absorb these various, through their media and for their the family telling me, his gestures, his voice intonations, his idiosyncrasies, and all of the various things that you could conjure up. You didn't have to, because they were there. But the veracity being emphasized by his own family. And I will say to my dying day that were it not for the immeasurable aid of his beloved widow Bonnie, I never would have dared attempt the characterization.
And was she satisfied with your portrayal?
So much so that the first scene that I played, she was on the set. And we didn't shoot in continuity.
Mm-hmm.
The first scene we shot was an interior, and it was a scene where... Have you seen the picture?
Yes, sure.
It's a scene in the president's office where Rock says that he's not going to continue his schooling. He could have been a great chemist, you know, and he was the one that was one of the first discovered synthetic rubber. And he said no, that he had decided to make his life football. And we had this old wonderful German actor with us, and he said, "Football, Knut, football, and you could be one of the great teachers and professors of the world, football." Oh, and ridiculed the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And the completion of his little argument against it, I said, "Well, more than that, I'm in love with the girl." And I proceeded to tell how much I adored this girl, and she was also in my line of thinking. I believe that's what I should follow as my career, vocation, avocation, whatever terminology you want to utilize. And she watched the scene and said, "Cut," and I came over and knelt beside her chair and looked up at her with, you know, hopes of affirmation, whatever you want to say. And she looked at me and patted me on the head, and she said, "Patty, I could have closed my eyes and thought you were making love to me." And I knew I had it made. It was a wonderful, exciting experience of sentiment and genuine response from his widow.
Well, your love for the role certainly came through on the screen. No question about it. As a matter of fact, didn't you... You didn't use a double for...
No, I was 40 years old, and I did everything from the blocking, tackling, and passing, and receiving. Mm-hmm. And I have a couple of pictures. Well, it was in my book where I'm 3 feet off the ground, punting. The illustration is in the book. And, of course, the extras and the umbrellas were people who later went on to... One of them was Mike Krankovich. One of them was Rosenberg, who produced great pictures like the remaking of Mutiny on the Bounty, which I don't think he's too proud of, but I mean, he made a lot of others. And all these college kids, you know, and I was in there at 40 years old, of age, racing up and down the field with them. And it wasn't, of course, I played football at Marquette University. And so even after 20 years, I'd still, you know, played it along with my kids at home in the yard, and I hadn't done much blocking or tackling in the play, but now I did. And there it is for man and boy to view on the screen, even as we're sitting here, because they run it every football season, sometimes out of season.
Did Ronald Reagan, who played George Gipp in the film Didn't you have something to do with his getting that role in the picture?
Oh, I guess everything. He had done one picture I remember that we were together. It was Cowboy from Brooklyn. One of the wild farces. He played a reporter in it with a lot of other fellas, but he was under contract. And he knew that Rocky had been cast. It would be months before they shot the picture. You know, publicity-wise, it had gone around the country, the world probably. Because Rockney was world-renowned. When he said to me, "Mr. Brown, who's going to play the part of the Gipper?" Which was such a great figure in the picture. "Well," I said, "I don't know. I don't think it's been cast. I don't think it's been cast at all." I mean, he said, "Sure, would I play it?" So we got talking about his background, and I went to Warner. And I told him, I said, "You know, there's a kid who got under contract here." And I said, "You know, it's more than a lot of actors. This kid knows his way around. I've watched him at noontime. He throws the football around." And did. I said, "He'd be a..." "I should give him a test. Play the gear." "Ah," he said, "he's a radio announcer we got from Des Moines, Iowa." I said, "Well, you signed him. You must have great hopes for his potential. I should give him a whack at this, and I'll read the lines for him. I'll do the same with the back of the camera."
Mm-hmm.
"So he doesn't have to be reading his lines to a gobo or to an offstage electrician or something, or a script girl." So anyway, he Jack Deere, Hal Wallace was then the production manager. And that was it. He got the role. And as I said one night on Carson's show, the ironic part of it is he played the Gipper, and eventually became the governor of California. I played the title role, and I became the president of the Holy Name Society. I saw him a few weeks ago. I went up to Sacramento, and we had a nice visit.
What can you tell us quickly about the... I say quickly because I know you have to go. A good film with Ann Sheridan and James Cagney called Torrid Zone.
You know what they used to call it? Front page in the tropics.
You had a white suit.
Well, you remember that. Yeah. Oh. A lot of rapid dialogue.
Sure.
Yeah, I love that picture. Ann was my leading lady in so many pictures. And I just adored her. She was so, what a grand girl. Well, she was in Indianapolis Speedway. She was in San Quentin. She was in, these were the pictures together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Making of O'Malley, The Great O'Malley. She said we better change that title, The Making of O'Malley. We never have a little, which we laughed about many times. And Angels with Dirty Faces, she wasn't quite my leading lady because I played a priest in it, and she was in it. And Torrid Zone.
Mm.
And several pictures. Who else was in Torrid Zone? Wasn't Andy Devine in that?
Yeah, I think he was.
Yeah, Andy Devine was in it. And a fellow who's been in semi-retirement, a Jewish actor. Oh, he's great. Tobias.
George Tobias?
George Tobias. He was in it. And Jerry Cowan, Jerome Cowan. He's a very great character role. He was in it. And Bacon directed that too, I believe.
You hardly ever went on location with the Warner Brothers film, didn't you? Most of that stuff was done right
out
there.
One picture we did.
Burbank.
A couple that I did. Well, Oil for the Lamps of China, which is one of my favorite pictures. Mervyn LeRoy directed. Oh, yes, we went on location way up north in California for that. And then, we had some other... the picture with Henry Fonda and myself, Slim. We went way up northern California. The telephone picture over there. Telephone workers. Fighting 69 was out on the ranch. G-Men was out on the ranch. This one with Bob Armstrong. But most of them, you build them right on stage, you know. Which has always been one of the amazing illusions of Hollywood, of course. Unless they do some rebuilding or something, Hollywood is the thing of the past. I mean, as far as the original. It's a jungle now that is made up mostly, taken over by the new media. And it's rather a sad commentary on a place that gloried in such wonderful tinsel and carousel of joy and romance and abandoned and happiness and camaraderie that was great in the 30s and 40s. That'll never come back. That's gone, because you can't resurrect that kind of thing. And I do think that the pendulum is swinging back, and it's inevitable that we will make the type of pictures that a lot of people don't agree with me. I was on the Cup show the other night, and I think everybody on the show didn't like Love Story. And I don't necessarily have to agree with other people, and I loved it. Loved every bit of it. Sure, it was a lot of Golden Bannon. It was gone. It probably was soap opera, but it was done beautifully, and I liked it. I liked every bit of it. I didn't necessarily have to agree with a lot of people, which would be nameless. But Frank Capra liked it, too. But I think it's coming back, and I think the obvious now is the sign. When you go in to see these pictures, it is so... Now, and they have all the nudity in the four-letter words. I don't object to nudity at all if it's pertinent to the context, you know, if it serves its purpose. But if you're doing it just to make a fast buck, if it becomes lascivious in its impact, what good is it? Of course, nudity, what the greatest thing in the world at the Louvre or the Metropolitan, what is greater than the nudity? When those guys started to undress on the stage and on the screen, I said, forget it. Forget it. But I do think that it's coming back, because a lot of the producers could have taken a couple of these out of Walt Disney's book, who made some great, wonderful pictures. And What's Wrong with Gone with the Wind, which will never be, doesn't seem, it's like Babe Ruth's record. Records are made to be broken. Probably someday a picture will top it. But it's not going to be these pictures, which will be nameless, because I'm not going to hurt any producer or actor. They'll never top it. And Sound of Music won't be topped. And all you have to do is go back to the archives of the past and look at some of the greats. But I think they saw what was happening, that it was crumbling, the industry, the great dynasty. And here guys are going to rush in for a fast buck, and somebody who doesn't care about disrobing and who doesn't care about using, you know, the four-letter word department. But what I started to say was, when they start laughing, the audience, when that becomes ludicrous, and they laugh at the screen when it's supposed to be an obvious plot and a degree of a serious note, you know, it's like when they laugh at Khrushchev hitting the table with his shoe, who's supposed to be a great statesman.
Yeah.
Once you become the become ludicrous in the eyes of the public, that's the beginning of the end. And I think, as I said, to be repetitive, it's inevitable that it's going to come back, and we'll see some of the great pictures made again. And well, look at some of the wonderful pictures, like the Snake Pit. Madame Curie was the great picture that Muni won the award for. Pasteur.
Zola, he was in.
Zola. I'm down Yankee Doodle Dandy. Well, I mean, the millions of dollars, plus the great beauty and the great adornment of artistry that was in the within their context. Olivia de Havilland winning the award for Snake Pit, which was a great demand on her prolific dramatic talent. And there's so many, you can go on and on. But they saw that, here comes this enemy of their arch enemy coming in and taking over the TV media, which they better watch it too, or they'll go down the drain, because everything has become so repetitious. Once a good plot comes out, then they're going to make 3, 4, 5 doctor series. They're going to make 10 bonanzas. And they're going to make 12 psychiatrist pictures. And that's the beginning of the end. So I think the smart picture people, Frank points this out in his book, I don't know when, but I think by the time when they'll finally come sneaking through, when you'll see again the great panorama of wonderment of the celluloid.
You know, it is rare.
You sound like John Bailey, sir.
No, you sound like Pat O'Brien. It is rare that an actor has one great role that he is proud of and always will be remembered for. And yet, Pat O'Brien, you've had 3 great roles just to start. Father Duffy and Canute Rockne and Hildy Johnson. right through your career.
And also The Iron Major, which was a great football picture.
Yes, of
course. Frank Cavanaugh. And, well, outside of that, and without trying to be brash or saccharine, two pretty good roles in my life have been husband and father, which are pretty tough to top. Being married for 40 years to the same gal and having four wonderful children, six grandchildren. As I said in the beginning, there's no price tag on memories and there's no price tag on a good family life.
And you're here in the Chicago area at Drury Lane with two members of your family.
That's right.
Your wife and daughter.
The youngest child.
Out here at Drury Lane in the comedy Paris is Out.
You're going to 16th time working for Tony DeSantis, who is not one of the most visionary men in show business, but he saw the great potential in the round, mm-hmm. along with what he's done for people who don't have to spend. A kid wants to take his gal out. He's dead today if he wants to go into Loop Cedar. Mm-hmm. They go to dinner, $50 is gone right now, right?
Sure.
But Tony saw this great potential, and he's been obviously and definitely been the greatest guy that I've ever worked for in the world of entertainment. The proof of it is here I am for the 16th time, and that's something, but it is a record for returning.
Well, I've seen you here on the stage at least 8 or 10 of those 16 times, and when I look around, I see so many of the same people that I may have seen at a Pat O'Brien show here years before. It's great. People love you, and they come to see you, and they're new faces and old faces, and you're just a great draw for the Drury Lane Theater, and actually what it is that Pat O'Brien is drawing his fans from, 52 years of show business?
I suppose, and it's a great joy because it's an ethnic group. They have all types come here, and it's wonderful. And if Chicago, of course, it's like old home week. Before I ever went to Hollywood, I played theaters here in Chicago, you know, like I mentioned in the beginning, which is now a movie house, and then I played three theaters that are torn down. The Cork Theater, which was Sport Herman's Theater, the Adelphi Theater, and the George M. Grant Theater, and I played the Chicago Theater. I did a personal appearance there for a week back in 1941. So, Chicago, I have, I suppose, through the years, built up a following, I hope, and I have so many friends here in Chicago, from Mary Daly on down, because that annual parade is part of my...
That's right, you're always part of this.
I had a message last year. I was in St. Paul. I was playing a nightclub there at Diamond Jim's, and there wasn't any way I could get here.
Pat O'Brien, a highlight of our career has been this chance to talk with you about so many highlights of your career. Before you go, would you be kind enough to recite that wonderful old Irish benediction, the one you use to open your book and the one you usually use to close your performance here at Drury Lane every evening?
Well, Chuck, it's a translation from the Gaelic, and I was aided and abetted by Maureen O'Hara, who speaks beautiful Gaelic. Her name, incidentally, is Fitzsimons, a real name. I met her parents in Dublin. So I took various notes of little toasts and blessings along the way, and she translated them for me, and then I put them all into one. And in its completeness is, may God sleep on your pillow. May he hold you in the hollow of his hand. May the roads rise up to meet you. Fair weather to your heels. May the wind be ever at your back. And may you all be a long time in heaven before the devil knows you're gone. God bless all of you and you, Chuck.
Thank you, Pat O'Brien, and thanks for sharing your memories with us today on Those Were the Days.
Thank you.